Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our subject again today for the second time is prohibition. Prohibition, of course, references the only constitutional amendments. There were two of them. To involve a drug, and that drug, of course, was alcohol. Last time we talked about the creation of prohibition. This time we'll talk about its demise, and we'll talk specifically and at some length to a fascinating fellow by the name of Art Bielek, the former chief of police of Cook County, Illinois, who's going to tell us all about the mob violence that was one of the primary reasons for the fall of prohibition. In the meantime, however, I have with me Aaron McLaughlin, one of my co-workers at the Appalachian School of Law, and he's going to tell us a little bit more specifically how prohibition ended. Aaron, how the heck are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Tremendous, tremendous. Now, we've got the 18th Amendment, which created prohibition it went into effect in 1920. But a mere 13, 14 years later, all of a sudden, we're doing exactly the opposite with the 21st Amendment, right?
Correct.
What happened? Why did this massive movement go in the opposite direction in just a little over a decade?
Well, I think that there was a lot of side effects to the prohibition enforcement that a lot of the policymakers didn't anticipate when the 18th Amendment went into effect. One statistic does have the amount of drinking prior to prohibition to after prohibition suggests that alcohol consumption was cut in half.
Cut in half. So in some sense, prohibition did work.
Well, there's always that statistic, but then there's other angles of looking at it. One thing, though, is even though some of the consumption amount did decrease, arguably, nationwide, there's also a lot of people who still wanted to continue drinking alcohol after prohibition. So since there is still that high demand for alcohol, then there emerged a black market willing to supply this demand, even though it was illegal. So the 1920s were a period of time in U.S. history that were marked by a lot of illegal bootlegging activities and gang operations and organized crime in general.
Right. In fact, prohibition sort of supercharged crime in the United States and really led to what we now call organized crime. By giving it, essentially handing it this entire market, which I think prior to prohibition, the brewing and distilling market was something like the fifth biggest industry in the United States. Yeah. And now, and essentially what prohibition did was hand it over to criminals.
Who
pay no taxes, who take all their ill-gotten gains and buy themselves protection from judges and from police. And so the corruption really was rampant during those 10 or 15 years, wasn't it?
It was. A lot of the places prior to prohibition, you had a lot of saloons and whatnot, which came under condemnation by a lot of people. But then, even though the saloons were outlawed, you had a lot of squeakeasies.
Squeakeasies or speakeasies?
Yeah, or speakeasies.
They squeak that much there. But
yeah,
they did say,
sorry about that.
That's all right.
But anyway, you know, they were illegal alcohol places, and there was a lot of them, you know, in the 1920s.
Right. And they didn't pay taxes.
Didn't pay any taxes.
And that's the big difference, is that you had a big industry that paid lots of taxes and that, you know, no more corrupt than any other industry, I suppose. And then all of a sudden it was turned over to the bad guys. And it was sort of an employment act for bad guys. And all of that violence, of course, led to a lot of reaction. And that's probably the single most important reason that prohibition was itself repealed. Also, perhaps, the Great Depression, right?
Yeah, I think that also had an effect on it, you know, in the later part of the 20s, you know, when they implemented prohibition, you know, it was better economic times. And and then the 30s, the Democratic Party in the 1932 election ran on a platform to repeal prohibition. So,
and a lot of that was just economics, you know, let's bring that industry back into the fold, let's increase employment, let's increase our tax revenues by making it legal again. And then the 18th Amendment was introduced, and very rapidly after the Democrats took control in 1933, It was ultimately ratified, wasn't it?
Yeah, within a year, the 21st Amendment was passed and ratified.
Wow. Well, we'll talk more with Art Bielek in just a second about the details of at least one city's experience with the corruption fostered by Prohibition. And then later, Aaron, would you come back and we'll talk maybe about a local connection to Prohibition and Al Capone. Okay?
That'd be great.
All right. We recently spoke with Art Bielek, the former chief of police of Cook County, Illinois, and the author of a book on the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the high point of mob violence in 1920 Chicago.
Now, if I understood you correctly then, Al Capone did not come to power in Chicago through his own ruthlessness. It was actually some other people who shot at Al Capone's boss and who essentially took the boss out of the picture. And Al Capone...
He filled the vacancy.
He just filled a vacancy. Okay, right. That's a little bit different, too. I think most people think that Capone shot his way to the top of the South Side gang, but apparently that was not true.
He probably would have never been the boss because Torrio was really too smart, too clever for that, and you needed a businessman of Torrio's acumen to run an operation like he was building. He had 7 breweries running at that time. He had beer distribution routes. All over the south side of Chicago, and he was making linkages with various of these 8 gangs that I had talked about. But the beer wars continued. Capone continued to use his ruthless shotgun approaches and then gradually found and discovered the machine gun, the Thompson submachine gun, and they got its name. Thompson submachine gun became the Tommy gun. And that's how that nickname was arrived at. And that was used in 1 or 2 shootings. It mystified the police. They had not even heard of the gun.
Oh, really?
And they couldn't figure out how so many bullets could get splattered in the front of a tavern or whatever it was that the people were shooting at and how so many cartridges would be laying out on the ground there.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but a Tommy gun shot a 50 caliber bullet, didn't
45
it?
45 caliber.
45, so very large.
Oh,
slug.
Yes. And as so large as was being used anywhere in the whole United States at that time. And in fact, ranchers were using them, and mine operators in their wars with the unions were using them.
Okay.
And they were manufactured for the military. The military, because it was such a strict bureaucracy, and they liked their old Springfield rifles and their big, powerful tripod-based machine gun, they didn't want to buy them. So it turned out that the maker of these machine guns had a warehouse full of them, and he began selling them retail. You could walk into a gun store and buy a machine gun, which is, of course, what the hoodlums did.
That's hilarious. So you've got this remarkably powerful weapon that can spray these very large slugs in high quantities. It's like the perfect gangster weapon.
Yes, it was. Exactly.
And it was there available just to buy from your local friendly gun dealer.
Yes. And it didn't even need a license of any kind.
Well,
at that particular time, the biggest mob that was still operating in Chicago was the North Side Gang. And as the name implies, they were on the north side of Chicago. The Chicago River downtown sort of splits the city into a north and south half, where the Wrigley Building and the Tribune Tower are located. And on the south bank of that was a formidable gang, composed of multi-ethnic groups, but particularly Irish. And on the south bank was the Capone gang, Colosimo Torrio Capone gang, with a number of Italians, but there also were people of diverse nationalities in that as well. The Chicago mob was always composed of people from different nationalities, and though people in their mind think of it as all Italian because of something like The Godfather, that was not the case. And there were people at fairly high positions in the Chicago mob that were Jewish or Greek or Polish or what have you. So inevitably, the two big gangs, the North Siders and the South Siders, began to fight. And Capone was using a lot of street strategy, and he knocked off the head of the North Side Gang in a ruthless killing in his flower shop that he was running. And two killers came in to get a wreath for a departed gangster who had been shot in a gangland shooting. And they greeted the owner, each one grabbing one hand, and with their free hand, they pumped him full of lead, and that took care of the head of the North Side Gang.
That was a scene that was dramatized in at least one movie I've seen. I don't recall which one it was.
Probably Scarface.
Yes, exactly right. Okay, so these movies are, in fact, taking real events and, as you say, romanticizing them.
The book, there was a book about Al Capone that was written at the time, a fiction book by a newspaper man, and that's lightly fictionalized everything that was going on. And that book then became the seedbed for the movie. So the events that we've seen in those movies came from the book, which came from real life.
Right.
And that's how that all came about. And so now with their head gone, the North Side Gang had to get a number two, and they did. And the next in command took over, and he was crossing State Street in front of Holy Name Cathedral when he got machine gunned to death from two marksmen that were up in the buildings on the adjacent corners. And that took care of the head of the North Side Gang again. But like a many-headed serpent, the third in command took over. And unfortunately, he was picked up for police by questioning. And while being moved from police headquarters to the criminal courts building, a tussle occurred in the back seat of the car, so the police said. And in the tussle, he attempted to secure the gun of one of the officers and ended up being shot dead.
How unfortunate. What a remarkable coincidence.
We'll never know the true story of that event. Mm-hmm. But that took care of the third in command. And the last one standing was a fellow by the name of, nickname at least, of Bugs Moran.
Right.
And Bugs Moran took over the North Side Gang. And now some of the other of the eight had either given up to Capone or had merged with Capone. And the remaining two were sort of laying low. And it was only the North Side Gang that still was a menace to Al Capone, who now had decided that he was going to become the boss of all Prohibition rackets in Chicago. And, of course, Prohibition was still running full tilt. We're talking about the late 1920s now. And so Capone decided that he had to get rid of the North Side Gang and had to get rid of Bugs Moran and his chieftains, and particularly his two main killers who had machine gun Capone's main killer in a phone booth in a hotel, but who had lived once again like Johnny Torrio. Machine gun Jack McGurn survived that killing. And so a group of Capone gangsters went up to a small farm and a sort of a lodge that was run by one of the gangsters in a southern edge of Cook County. And they sat down and they planned the end of the North Side Gang. They actually schemed and talked this over. They even had two politicians with them there who were as much mobsters as they were, but happened to be going up a different ladder at the particular time. One of them ultimately became an elected city official. And they decided that the way to do this was to get a gang that wasn't known to the North Siders. Capone had some connections with a gang that was in St. Louis, headed by a fellow called Machine Gun Burke, and sent word down there to come up to Chicago. And Burke came up and brought up several of his henchmen with him to Chicago, and they began meeting secretly with Capone and with Machine Gun Jack McGurn to plan the ending of the North Side Mob. And this went on for several months. What they decided to do is they found out where the North Side Gang was meeting, and it was at 2122 North Clark Street in a truck garage there that was the distribution center for the booze that the North Side Gang was distributing. And Capone's men discovered that they met there each morning, but sometimes there'd be a few there, sometimes there'd be some more, sometimes trucks would be active and there'd be people loading and unloading them. And so they had to try to plan a scheme that was going to get around all of this and was going to do the job that Capone wanted to be done. And someone came up with the inspiration of, we'll have the killers look like policemen.
Oh, that's a pretty effective tactic, isn't it?
Yes, and they wanted to catch them off guard. They didn't want a gun battle where several of them were going to be killed and where they might not get the North Side Gang. They wanted to be successful. So they got two touring cars, Cadillac touring cars, which at that time were being used by the Detective Bureau in the Chicago Police Department, and they actually outfitted them to look like Detective Bureau cars. They put a big gong on the side. They put a shotgun rack in the back windowsill. And for all outward appearances to passersby that were streetwise, they'd say, oh, there go the dicks. Mm-hmm. So they had these hidden away in a garage on the north side of the city, and they planned their day in advance. And it got to be winter. And it was, of course, a snowy, cold winter, as they are in Chicago. And they rented an apartment on the east side of Clark Street and moved in there and began to keep their eyes on the North Side mob. Well, they decided to use a tactic that had successfully lured Big Jim Colosimo to Colosimo's Cafe some nine years earlier, and they set up a phone call that would come to this headquarters from someone that the North Side Gang trusted about a shipment of alcohol that would be coming in. And so the grounds were set for the killing that was going to occur. And on a snowy morning, a cold, chilly morning in Chicago, with the great big streetcars, which were now electrically driven with overhead wires, rumbling past out in front, the lookouts were on one side of Clark Street. The Moran gang began to assemble on the west side of Clark Street, and it was St. Valentine's Day, February 14th. 1929. And as the lookouts watched, one by one, members of the North Side Gang made their way down Clark Street and popped in the door of S and C Cartage. There wasn't much going on inside. There were some trucks in there. There was a repairman repairing them. He had a great big German Shepherd dog that he kept there at night as a watchdog. They put on an old pot of drip coffee where you put the grounds in the top and you put the water in and it worked its way, boiled up through the coffee and then boiled down again, cooking. And finally, the lookout decided that everyone was present, and they made their phone call to a tavern that was about 2 miles away and said, they're all here, come and get them. And so the killers piled into these two police cars and came moving into the north side. One went into the alley behind the garage. One pulled up out in front, and two uniformed officers and two what appeared to be plainclothesmen walked in, observed by several people who happened to notice them pull up out in front. It was just about 10 a.m. in the morning. The other one in the back was only seen by a small neighborhood boy, and he was cutting down the alley, going to meet with several friends of his to play that particular morning. And he saw what appeared to him to be a police car in the back alley, and men in uniform getting out, going into the back door of the SMC garage. And he thought, boy, there's going to be a raid. Mm-hmm. And he ran around to the front to see what was going to go on. And when he got to the front side of the building, he saw this other police car. And he was the only witness to have seen the rear car.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. We're talking with Art Bielek, a former chief of police of Cook County, Illinois, and he's telling us the fascinating tale of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the height of mob violence that led to the repeal of Prohibition. Stay tuned.
How are you going to wet your whistle when the whole darn world goes dry? What are you going to do in the morning when you need a nip to open up your eyes? Now what of the wedding and the christening and the wake when your dear friends die? Oh, how are you going to wet your whistle when the whole darn world goes dry?
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, where former Cook County, Illinois Police Chief Art Bielek is telling us the fascinating tale of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Inside, we have to reconstruct what occurred because no one ever who was involved in it, certainly not the dead, and the living chose not to, left a written account of what occurred inside the premises. But from reconstructing the event, and I've done this hundreds of times in my mind, and I've done it with forensic scientists and with men from the crime labs, it appears that it went like this, that the Moran gangsters were in there talking, awaiting the arrival of the truck, and they were caught by surprise by the uniformed police officers coming in from the front and the rear. But they weren't too concerned about this because they had been paying uniformed police officers for 9 years to allow their operation to continue on the north side, and they'd been paying off the aldermen of three different police districts to be allowed to operate. So I'm sure they thought that it was going to be a friendly shakedown by the dicks, and maybe even a couple of them would have to go downtown and go through the whole process down there of being charged, making bail, being discharged the next morning, and getting back to work again. Who knows what thoughts were going through their mind, but clearly they were ordered to go over to the wall. It was a brick wall, and I was still able to see that before this garage was torn down. It was a plain sewer brick, as we called it in Chicago, wall, or common brick, as it's more commonly called throughout the United States, and really the layer of brick behind face brick that would be in the front of a home. They all faced that wall, and the two men that had machine guns underneath their long blue overcoats that Chicago policemen wore at that time, took out those machine guns and opened up almost, we think, within a minute or two at the most of entering that garage, and began to spray back and forth with their two machine guns. One had a drum with 50 bullets, one had a straight set of cartridges in a chamber with 25 bullets. They expended all of those bullets, and then there was even shots fired from one revolver and shots fired from one shotgun. And so the seven men at the wall crumpled to the floor in all grotesque shapes. We now know that scene, because that was what the police were going to find, were these bodies laying on top of one another, some against the wall, some across a chair, some face down on the floor, some face up looking at the ceiling of the garage. And the gunmen, the killers from Machine Gun Burke's gang, filed out the front and back doors. Witnesses saw that, got into the two cars, and drove off. Upstairs, a landlady of the building where the cartridge company was located had heard the noise of the machine guns going off, had no idea what it was, because this wasn't even in the presence of machine guns had not been reported in the newspapers yet, so she wasn't sure what to make of the sound. But she was curious enough so that she made her way down from the second floor, walked to the door, tried to look through the window of the office, but that was just a small walled-in room and there was nobody in there, pushed on the front door and it wouldn't open. So she was still curious, went back upstairs, got a roomer. He came down the stairs with her to placate her, I suppose, and he pushed on the door and it opened up. So he went down a little hall about 6 feet long to the end of alongside the office, and there was another door, and he pushed that open, and there was the most, he said, grotesque sight he had ever seen. The room was still filled with smoke. They weren't using smokeless powder in those days, mm-hmm. from the machine guns, the pistol, and the shotgun. And on the floor were these bodies in all these grotesque shapes, and blood running in streams towards the little sewer basin in the center of the floor. And unbelievable as it might seem to his eyes, one man flat on the floor on his stomach, inching himself forward on his elbows and pushing with his toes, and he didn't know what to do. He stood there for a moment.
So someone survived this?
Yes, one did.
Wow.
Transfigured, he didn't know what to do there, but he said, "I'm going to get help," he screamed to the man, and ran out the door and yelled to the landlady, "Call the police, there's men laying all over in there, I think they're dead." Well, in those days, you called the station, not downtown, because we're before the days of radio dispatch. And so she called the Hudson Avenue District, and a sergeant answered. He got the message garbled, but he yelled over to a sergeant that was lounging over on one of the chairs, and he said, "Something's going on up there on North Clark Street. I don't know if it's a fight or a disturbance." He said, "You better take a look at it." So the sergeant looked around for one of the patrol cars, none of which were in sight, but there was a telephone repairman fixing the phones in the station, and he was a city employee. So the sergeant said to him, "Will you give me a lift up there?" And he said, "Sure." And then there was a police van standing there. In those days, there were people that hung around police stations, palled around with policemen, just as there were people who palled around with the gangsters, sort of gangster wannabes. Well, there were police wannabes. So he was there. So he said, "Can I come with?" So he said, "Sure." It was a day, broad daylight, and the sergeant didn't think there was much problem. So the three of them pile into this little roadster. It was a tight fit, and they hustle right over there. It was a short ride of about 6 blocks, and the sergeant jumped out, and he walked through the front door, and there was the rumor pointing into the doorway, pointed, and he was shaking. And so the sergeant didn't know what this all was about, and he walked in, and he sees the same scene. Now, because of his police training, he immediately saw, what are the things that I need to do here? And he saw this man that was away from the other people, and the fellow was saying, "Help me, help me." And he walked over to him, and sure enough, it was one of the gangsters that he knew, and we don't know exactly how they knew one another, but he knew him very well. And he knelt down and said, "It's me. Do you know who I am?" And he says, "Yes." He said, "Get me some help. I've been shot." So the sergeant went back out the front door, went to a telephone, called the station, and said, "Send everything. Call the crime lab, call the patrol wagons, call the commissioner, get the chief of detectives, tell the state's attorney," and ran back in again and tried to hold the fort while he waited. And pretty soon he could hear the sirens coming up from all directions out in the distance. And in through the doors came the first of what would soon to be 30 to 40 policemen of all ranks, up to including the chief of detectives himself, all crowded into the garage. Ultimately, the state's attorney, the coroner comes over. Everybody wants to see this unbelievable thing that had never happened before in a city that was replete with gangland wars. Six people laying on the floor dead, and one having been rushed by a patrol wagon to the nearest hospital. A policeman stayed with that man, by the way, for an hour, and he finally said, "It's getting dark in here." Pardon me, that's probably how he said it. He said, "I'm getting cold," and those were his last words. And he never revealed anything other than, "Coppers did it," was the one clue that he had given to the police officers that were standing by his bedside.
Wow. That's a remarkable story. So seven guys lined up against the wall, six of them dead, one of them crawling away, and he refuses to say anything about who did it except coppers did this.
Did it.
Okay.
All one word, did it.
Right.
Chicago talk.
Right.
And copper is the nickname for police.
Right.
And then he expired.
Right.
And so, and with him really was the last chance that the police were going to have to get any kind of, an eyewitness identification of the killers who actually committed the murder. Now, a huge uproar was raised, as might be imagined, in the press. In those days, there were six newspapers in Chicago, and some of them printed as many as 4 to 6 editions a day. And so the word was being flashed downtown by telephone, by every reporter that they could get to the scene, by every photographer that they could summon. And the papers were replating and reprinting. They were calling in the newsboys that had gone home from the mornings. They were calling in early, the newsboys from the afternoon. And they were running up and down the streets of the Loop and on the near north side and the near west side, screaming, "Wextra, Wextra, read all about it. Massacre on the north side, massacre on the north side." And the headlines were 3 and 4 inches tall.
Yeah, they sold a lot of newspapers. And just for our younger listeners, of course, who might not even be familiar with newspapers anymore, those days a paper would typically come out once or maybe twice a day with their regular editions. But if something really significant happened in between those press runs, they might come out with what were called extra editions.
And they would have extra printed right on.
Right. And then that's an opportunity, obviously, for the newspaper to sell more copies. But it's just sort of interesting from the perspective of 2011 that that was the best and quickest way to get your information was these sheets of paper that were being put out every couple of hours or something and hawked by newsboys on the street. Something from an earlier era. But I wanted to return to something you said a moment ago. It's quite understandable today that we would have a very quick press reaction to such a massacre. And in fact, sadly, when these things occur, we do react to them. There's a part of me that wonders, given all the gang violence that had gone on in the preceding 10 years in Chicago with people shooting at each other with machine guns on Michigan Avenue, hadn't they gotten used to this sort of violence? I mean, I'm almost surprised that people in Chicago would react that way. It almost seems like another day in Chicago.
Well, it was. And what was different about this and what caught the public eye were two things. One, there had never been one of this dimension. No, the most that had ever been shot before were 3 people. And in some cases, one or more of those were only wounded. Now we had one with 7 dead men, all members of one gang, the Northside Gang, immediately perceived by the people that read the daily papers, and everybody in Chicago read a paper in those days, and they were very current on the gang wars and what was going on. And it was clear what had happened here was Capone had made an attempt to knock off the Northside Gang. And, of course, the newspapers felt that way as well, and there were headlines about the Capone mob. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what it was being called. Instead of the Southside Gang,
right,
having done this. And the police, of course, took off in every direction, given that they were in the payroll of the Northside mob and in the payroll of the Southside mob. This made it sort of a sensitive matter that they were dealing with. And Capone at that time had achieved a fair amount of political savvy and was paying off not only aldermen, but the mayor as well. And so you had a very difficult situation as to exactly how this was going to be investigated and resolved, and what happened at the end of the day, even though there had been endless investigations and endless theories in the newspaper day after day, as each paper tried to beat the other one with a new scoop as to who had committed the murders and to what the police were going to do next. At the end of the day, no one was really convicted of this murder, although machine gun Jack McGurn, remember him, one of the planners of the event, mm-hmm. he had been living in the Stevens Hotel, which is today called the Conrad Hilton and Towers, the Hilton Hotel and Towers on Michigan Avenue at the south end of Chicago's downtown, was then called the Steven. He was living there with a girlfriend who was quite attractive, and the newspaper photographers used all of their 4x5 slides taking photos of every chance they had because of her unquestionable beauty.
These gangsters seemed to attract the attractive women, didn't they?
Well, they certainly did, and she was certainly one of them. I think he got tired of living up there in the hotel before the murder and on the day of the murder, and eventually a tip was given to two detectives in the Detective Bureau, and they led a raid on the room in the hotel. And I'm sure that it probably came from McGurn himself, who wanted to get this thing over with. And they went in, and sure, there he was. He had some guns, but he made no attempt to fight with them at all. They were probably people he also knew. And they took him down to the station, booked him. The state's attorney promptly indicted him. And he appeared in court a number of times until that sort of ran itself out and he was discharged. So McGurn was never actually convicted of anything and was only sort of the token person charged with the crime. Now, in the meantime, something very interesting emerged, and that was that on the floor amongst the seven men would know Bugs Moran. Bugs Moran, according to the folklore of the day, had been approaching the garage when he saw this police car, he thought, out in front. And he thought, oh, it's one of those raids. And he ducked into a doorway, and then he heard the shots, and he and his buddy took off the other way and never did get to the garage that particular day. He checked into a hospital in Evanston, which is a suburb of Chicago, and stayed there for several days, and then went to Lake County, Illinois, and then finally to Wisconsin. And he got himself into some various rackets over time and finally got involved with holding up a bank and got put into the penitentiary. But he never came back to assume what was left of the remaining members of the Northside Gang and take that over. And instead, interestingly, their chief field manager of the Northside Gang, who also was not in the garage that day, took over the mob and brought it into the Capone fold.
Okay, so Capone
now had the entire city of Chicago from the southern city limits to the northern city limits, and as a matter of fact, in at least half of the suburbs to the north, west, and south of the city. So he was the undisputed ruler of gangdom and the undisputed ruler of the prohibition liquor and beer business in the whole Chicagoland area.
That is a remarkable tale. Now let's relate this to Prohibition. What was the significance of this massacre, other than just the sensationalism, and other than the immediate takeover by Capone? Did it have a wider significance with regard to the public and the public's reaction to it?
Well, it had a very significant difference, and that was because of the countless headlines, because of the sheer brazenness and the audacity of machine gunning in the daytime, seven men in the back of a truck garage. The public-spirited businessmen of Chicago, members of the Chicago Crime Commission, all got together and decided, we've finally got to do something about these killings. It can't be allowed to go on. And this Capone mob and this Al Capone have got to be dealt with. Now, they knew that the state's attorney seemed absolutely helpless. The police seemed absolutely clueless. And they didn't know where to turn. So they got on the train and went to Washington, D.C. And they commanded high enough importance in the business community in Chicago that they were able to get a meeting with the President of the United States, and they told him that Chicago was out of control, were their direct quote words, and that the police were helpless in dealing with this matter, and he had to have something done about Al Capone and that mob and that gang. And so he promised them that he would, and he met with his Attorney General. And the Attorney General met with the Secretary of the Treasury, and they tried to scope out a way to get at Capone and his gang. And the only one way that they could find that they thought was going to be a useful way was the income tax laws. They couldn't charge him with murder because it was not a federal crime. And their attempts at prohibition enforcement were sort of met with laughter across the major cities of the Eastern Seaboard and Chicago, because the people drank just as much during the period of Prohibition as they had drunk before the period of Prohibition, because the Prohibition agents were poorly trained, politically appointed, and were venal, just as were the police. And while there were a number of them that were honest, just as there were a number of police that were honest, there simply were nowhere near enough to do anything about this giant beer liquor industry that was feeding the United States from the Atlantic Ocean to the Mississippi River, mainly in the big cities of the North and the Northeast. And so they thought that possibly income tax would be the best approach, and they sent a huge squad of income tax investigators to look at books and records that had been seized and raided in Chicago by the police and the state's attorney's office. And in one of them, an alert Internal Revenue investigator found enough evidence of the fact that Capone was making millions of dollars a year and reporting tens of thousands in his income tax. And they slowly began to build a case against him.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. Our subject today is Prohibition, the only time the Constitution was amended for a drug. Stay tuned.
Prohibition is a failure, as anyone can see. For whiskey is sold in every town in the good old USA. Oh, the policeman will arrest you, he'll lock you up in jail. He'll drink up all your liquor and turn you out on bail.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and we're talking about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, one of the reasons that Prohibition was eventually repealed.
And of course, at the same time, what was occurring was the states had decided that they, especially those states east of the Mississippi, that they had their belly full of the mess that Prohibition had brought about, and the movement was underway to repeal the 18th Amendment. And it was steadily gaining headway, steadily moving through the Congress of the United States, and ultimately, as you know, the 18th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States was repealed, and Prohibition was going to go out in 1932 on January 1st.
Well, it sounds like Capone had quite a Pyrrhic victory then. He gained control of all of Chicago, finally, what he'd been trying to do all throughout the 1920s. But in doing so, he brought down the wrath of the federal government on his own head and eventually went to prison for tax evasion, and indeed contributed to this entire repeal of Prohibition, which had been the great engine of his wealth. And so maybe he would have been better off to leave Bugs Moran alone.
Oh, absolutely. In hindsight, that was clearly the case. He had gone too far. He had reached too far. He had gone beyond what would be considered reasonableness by the part of the general public, by the part of the government. He had broken the vase, and it was never going to come back together again for him. And so while he was still riding the crest of his popularity, he didn't realize that this income tax case was being amassed. He appeared publicly in many places. He went around the country, went to Atlantic City, went to Hot Springs, went down to Florida, bought a huge home out in Biscayne Bay, went to Canada, appeared at the ball games. Gabby Hartnett and other Cubs players raced over to sign, get his autograph and give him theirs. He appeared with important politicians in Chicago, was interviewed by the press repeatedly, gave grandiose interviews, made memorable quotes like, I don't know what the problem is, I'm just providing for the thirst that people have. I'm just a businessman like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's what he was engaged in. If you looked at the Prohibition business side of it, the terrorism side of it, the bombs that they threw, the people that they beat, the kidnappings that they did, and the murders that occurred was another side of Prohibition. It was a business on one side that was just like the alcohol and beer and wine business today, but on the bottom of it was a vicious, dark, black cancer that was spreading through the police departments, through the governments, even through the courts of the eastern cities in America, and was to give them a tremendous body blow that was going to take 20 to 50 years, in some cases, to fully recover from. One of the main unsung damages of Prohibition was the damage that it did to criminal justice in America.
Well, indeed, if we can go back to your own career, then it sounds as if you were sort of still cleaning up the leftover corruption from Prohibition, even as late as the 50s and 60s and 70s in Chicago.
And that's true. Unfortunately, when I was a police officer, gambling was still tacitly allowed in Chicago. And there were bookie joints throughout the city, not public in any way, but certainly not terribly secret, because everybody that bet had to know where they were, and they couldn't move day by day or they wouldn't be able to find them. So they were in the same old storefront day after day after day, and it would be a poor beat officer or a poor patrol car that didn't know where those were. And so instead of picking up from the saloons and from the beer distributors and from the breweries, the police turned to picking up from the gambling houses. And so there was still this element of corrupted police officers, and it's very difficult to be half corrupted, mm-hmm. just as it's difficult to be half pregnant, to use sort of a lame expression here.
Yeah, no, but I understand what you're saying.
Apt in this situation.
Right.
And I saw the very ends of that, and I'm pleased to say, because I'm still involved by working at the Chicago Crime Commission, where I'm executive vice president, with the law enforcement picture, and it's as different as day and night as it was from Prohibition. And we now have a different form of criminal justice in America than we had during all those years.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. Well, let's actually talk about 2011. Let's talk about today. Based upon all your experience as a police officer, as a sheriff, as all the other things that you've done, and based upon your extensive study of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and Prohibition generally, do you have any opinions about modern-day Prohibition, whether it's of gambling or whether it's of other controlled substances like marijuana? Is that the best way to handle those problems, or is it causing some of the same problems that we had back in the day?
Well, as you know, being a constitutional lawyer, there's two forms of criminal behavior by, under the eyes of the law, malum per se and malum prohibita, to use the old-fashioned Latin words that came out of the courts of the Inns of England. The one being basically the Ten Commandments. That's malum per se, evil per se, murder, rape, robbery, anything violently against a person, against their will. But then there's another whole big body of criminal law, which is malum prohibita, that which is prohibited, and those are the crimes that are statutorily wrong, but are not necessarily something that harms another person directly the way being assaulted would, or raped, or murdered. And that would include things like prohibition. Mm-hmm. A classic example of malum prohibita. The narcotics industry, prostitution would be another one. Gambling would be still another one. My experience, and I've spent my entire lifetime from when I was 23 years of age to now in this field, is that if you enact laws that the public does not agree with, those are not going to be enforceable by the few policemen that exist per capita in any parts of the world. It's just going to be disregarded one way or another, whether you're in Europe or whether you're in the United States or whether you're in Mexico. If the public does not believe that it's the right thing, if they want to engage in the activity, they're going to do this regardless of whether or not it's against the law. And so we have the young white teenagers and other young men from North Shore suburbs who've gone to good high schools and may even be in college, getting in their cars, driving into Chicago to go to the street drug markets to buy drugs. They know very well that that's illegal. The sellers know that it's illegal. The people in the buildings that overlook the corners know it's illegal. But because it's not viewed by these people as something that's harmful and hurtful to them personally, they don't oppose it. They don't report it. They do engage in it. They do participate. And so you've got a very difficult situation between people that think a field is wrong and that it ought to be prohibited, as did the Plains State representatives when prohibition was passed, and the Baptist ministers in the major cities of the country that thought that King liquor was such an evil, terrible thing. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but the people didn't feel that way. At a given moment, they were able to convince government to prohibit it, and the ensuing disaster, I'd call it, of prohibition followed. It would apply, once again, to gambling. I lived through the gambling era, and I saw casinos operating undercover, and bookie joints operating undercover, and the policy numbers racket operating undercover in Chicago. Today, all of those are legal by law. And the gambling industry on the criminal behavior side has virtually disappeared. There are no more handbooks in Chicago. There's no more casinos out in the county. Numbers is now the famous lottery.
Yeah, we watch it on television.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Slot machines are gone. They're replaced by video poker.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have an entirely different situation where it's regulated and taxed, and I'm sure there's abuses of it, but we do not have corrupt policemen. We do not have corrupt prosecutors or corrupt aldermen or corrupt state representatives. The crime syndicate was able to build in Illinois even a group of state representatives called the West Side Bloc in the Illinois General Assembly, whose primary reason for being there was to make sure laws weren't passed that was going to be contrary to the best interest of the Capone Syndicate, which became called the Organized Crime Syndicate, or the mob, and to make sure that laws that favored them were passed. And so as a result, Illinois, for example, had the most strict wiretap law of any state in the country.
And I did not know that.
It prohibited me as a state's attorney's organized crime investigator from tapping the phones of the organized crime syndicate. Now today that's been changed. The West Side Bloc is gone, and there's a state law allowing for wiretaps by state law enforcement officers, just as there is a federal one. So this is a very interesting area when you start weighing public interest and public need up against zeal on the part of people that may feel something is wrong and should be prohibited.
So what about narcotics then? Should we do the same thing with narcotics we've done with gambling and with alcohol, or is that somehow different?
Well, there's people, I've listened to all of the arguments. I've never personally been a narcotics investigator or involved directly in narcotics cases, but I certainly am aware of them and understand the field. Clearly, there's people that feel that a harmless marijuana cigarette is not a great problem. And that's why so much marijuana is smoked across the country and sold across the country today, and why judges take such a minor view of it. And in fact, in most big cities, if you're arrested for possession of marijuana cigarettes, the case is discharged in court or you're given supervision. There's not even a criminal charge placed against you. Now, on the other end of that spectrum is heroin and cocaine, which are drugs that cause the users great problems. Those are really not recreational drugs. And so they fall into sort of a different kind of a category from marijuana. And I would have to say that I honestly think that's probably in the best public interest that they not be allowed to be used by the general public. But it's possible that there may be forms of regulating them that are different from the ones today, where we have this endless battle between the forces of law and order on one side and the providers of narcotics on the other side, that seems to have gone on unabated since the days of President Nixon and his war on drugs.
Well, that was a fascinating discussion with Art Bielek, the former chief of police of Cook County, Illinois. And it reminds us that prohibition is still a topic today because we still prohibit the sale or the use, the possession of certain substances. They're not alcohol anymore. They are other things. And, of course, the question for today, as a matter of policy, not as a matter of constitutional law, but as a matter of policy, is whether that's the best way to treat the drug problem in our country. But let's talk a little bit more about Al Capone, and let's talk about his connection to our area. And once again, I've got Aaron McLaughlin with me, and he's got some fascinating information about Capone's connection with Johnson City, Tennessee.
Well, Al Capone's Operation Outfit out of Chicago was a nationwide operation distributing the banned alcohol and whatnot to the willing buyers. So there's a lot of cities around the United States that Al Capone had operations in, but it just so happens that Johnson City, Tennessee was one of those places. And Johnson City as a railroad town was often actually referred to as Little Chicago.
Oh, really? Little Chicago?
It was somewhat of a midway point between the real Chicago, Illinois, and then Miami, Florida, and it was a between
and Capone point. Liked to go down there. He liked to bet in the ponies. He liked to get down in the sunshine in the wintertime.
Yeah,
like a lot of rich Chicagoans, he likes to head south, and of course, this was right on the way. So,
well,
yeah, okay,
you know,
what did he do?
Another little convenient sort of thing was it said that around these parts in Appalachian, Tennessee, and North Carolina, that there's a lot of, how would you say?
Moonshining?
Yeah, moonshining.
Local
yes.
expertise.
Local, there you go.
There
local
we are.
Expertise in moonshining. So that might have been Johnson City was a place to
maybe actually purchase some stuff. Or,
purchase
some
stuff
some supply.
And just
okay.
send it on up. But some magazines around the time even listed Johnson City as a quote-unquote, a place of vice.
A place of vice.
Yeah, one of the top places of vice in the country if
really?
You're looking for that sort of thing, and that it was quote-unquote wide open in the 1920s.
I see. So, now, did Capone ever actually come here?
Well, there's not much official documentation if you're looking for that, but there is a lot of local legend that, yes, Capone did stop in Johnson City around the Montrose Apartments, the John Sevier Hotel or the Windsor Hotel were all areas where, you know,
he reputedly was.
Yeah, he was mm-hmm. at, or maybe some of his lieutenants or just mobsters in general. But, yeah, even to this day, the local lore is that Capone would stop over in Johnson City and just sort of hang out. And
in fact, weren't there some legends about underground passages and secret passageways and things?
Apparently, I'd read that even up to the 1960s that they had found abandoned speakeasy places or some hidden passageways dating back from the Prohibition era. It's really interesting.
Very interesting. And, in fact, I think even today there is a restaurant in Johnson City, downtown Johnson City, called Capone's, right?
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, we'll have to go there.
We will. Let's go.
Yeah, maybe we'll go for dinner tonight.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Right on.
It could happen. All right. Well, that's about all the time we've got, and what a fascinating tale it's been. We talked to Art Bielek, and we want to thank him very much for that extensive history of the mobs in Chicago. I want to thank Alex McLaughlin. Excuse me, not Alex, but Aaron. Alex is your older brother. I want to thank Aaron McLaughlin for coming in and telling us all about the local connection to Al Capone and about the thumbnail sketch of the history of Prohibition itself. My producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
The Appalachian School of Law will host a community forum on Prohibition, Moonshining, and Central Appalachia, Tuesday, September 27th, on the ASL campus in Grundy, Virginia. Sandwiches and soda will be served starting at 6 p.m. with music by the ASL Jug Band. At 7 o'clock, the forum will begin with previews of the new Ken Burns documentary, Prohibition. A panel discussion will follow, moderated by Stuart Harris, the host of Your Weekly Constitutional. This community forum is being produced in partnership with Blue Ridge PBS and with WETS. It's open to everyone and is free of charge. For more information, 888-895-WETS.